Good morning. This is a public rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedure Act, specifically 24-4-103 Colorado Revised Statutes. The day is Thursday, January 14, 2016, and the time is 9 a.m. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Conference Room on the third floor of the Office of the Secretary of State, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. I'm Deputy Secretary of State Suzanne Steyer, and I'm convening this hearing in accordance with the rulemaking notice published in the Colorado Register on December 25, 2015. To my immediate left is Ben Schler, Internal Operations and Legal Manager in the Elections Division. To my right is Judd Choate, Director of the Elections Division. To my far left, Andrea Geiger, Department Rulemaking Manager in the Administration Division. And to my far right is our Attorney General, Matt Grove, Assistant Solicitor General. The purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's election rules. As stated in the notice, the purpose of the rulemaking is to consider rule revisions necessary to ensure proper administration of legislation, establish uniformity in the administration of current law, organize existing rules for clarity, eliminate obsolete provisions, simplify existing rule language, remove language duplicative of statute, respond to comments from the Office of Legislative Legal Services, and ensure consistency with department rulemaking standards. The Secretary of State released a preliminary draft of proposed rules with the notice of rulemaking. Copies of the notice of rulemaking, draft statement of basis, and the draft rules are available on the office website and on the table in the back of the room. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. This meeting is audio recorded, and all comments become a part of the official legal record. This hearing is also being broadcast over the internet. For anyone who wishes to testify at this hearing, there are sign-up sheets on the table at the back of the room. You must sign up in order to testify. For the record, our office has received written comments on the proposed rules. All comments received will become a part of the official record of this hearing and will be posted online. At this time, all interested parties have an opportunity to submit any data, views, or arguments on amendments to the election rules in writing and, if desired, orally. This hearing is scheduled to conclude by 12 p.m. In the interest of time, I would request that you avoid simply repeating the testimony of others. When you speak, please introduce yourself for the recording when you begin, and if you represent an organization, please identify the organization. The first person signed up to testify is Sherry Davis. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Sherry Davis. I'm the Douglas County Elections Manager. I did submit some comments in writing last night, but I wanted to modify one of the comments that I had. So specifically, I wanted to address proposed rule 7.8.11C, and that's the requirement for the automated signature verification devices to be on a closed network. And we've been reviewing that to see what the impacts would be internally for that. And we would propose that and suggest you consider changing that word to secured network instead of closed network for a variety of reasons. On the second tier signature verification component, we utilize SCORE, and we would need access to SCORE in order to be able to complete that process. So we would support secured network rather than closed.
Okay.
Other than that, my comments are in writing and have been submitted.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks. Does anyone have any questions? No. All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Next person is Chris Pratt, also from Douglas County.
Thank you. And I will try not to belabor the points that have already been submitted in writing to the committee. But I have been asked to speak to emphasize a few of those points. Douglas County, you have the letter from both our commissioners and our clerk and recorder. They're concerned in particular about the uniform voting system and the rule that is proposed that would codify that counties may only purchase a uniform voting system approved by the Secretary of State, not a system of their choice or any qualifying system, as the rule currently states. Douglas County is concerned that creating a monopoly, as the policy that is proposed to go along with this rule would do, going with Dominion as the single source vendor. There are concerns that although this has some benefits, obviously, to the Secretary of State's office and the election staff here, and some benefits to narrow categories of voters or other groups, or in particular, unusual circumstances of extremely distressed counties, the costs, as recognized by the regulatory analysis submitted by this body, fall entirely on the counties. In fact, there is no cost noted to the Secretary of State. This is a decision for a policy and a rule change that will fall entirely on the counties. And those costs do not seem to be addressed, we understand, legally not required to be addressed in a regulatory analysis. However, also legally not prevented from being addressed. And there's some concern by our county that those were not addressed. And those costs are pretty considerable. Obviously, there's been some submissions by other counties and our county that there are significant financial costs to using a system that is not the choice of the counties. I know our county has several hundred thousand dollars we expect if we should have to go to a Dominion system. Jeffco submitted that they have several hundred thousand dollars they expect they would have to pay. So there's a financial burden, but beyond the financial costs, there are other costs to going to a unified voting system, single source vendor. A single system, one size fits all, obviously there's some concerns with that. Although this body has noted that there may be some cost savings to creating a monopoly, in that we can get a better cost individually for the systems from the vendor, there may be some long-term costs. So basically what's happened is counties that would go with that system anyway will see a savings. Counties that did not want to go with that system will not see a savings. Many of them will have to pay more. And the long-term costs to both those who desire the system and those who do not may be significantly higher if there are no alternatives allowed. In addition to that, if there are future innovations, although the system chosen may be considered the best right now, next year or the year after, if there's a significant innovation, we're all locked in to the system chosen now. And we're not quite sure that's in the best interests of Colorado voters and certainly the counties, who would be required to use a system they don't necessarily want. Our concern, and the reason I'm testifying, is just to make sure that these concerns are addressed. We understand that statutorily they may not be required to be addressed, and there has been a suggestion that it may be disingenuous for the counties to think that these concerns have not been addressed, but I assure you it is genuine. There is a concern that, although there was an opportunity to discuss these, that opportunity was not taken by this body.
I guess I'm confused by that. What do you mean an opportunity to discuss these concerns?
In the regulatory analysis, Douglas County asked for the regulatory analysis. And in that request, we specifically asked that the cost to counties be considered. The regulatory analysis simply said none.
Right.
And that cost is to the counties, but there was no exploration of what that cost would be.
But the regulatory analysis is an analysis of the rule. The rule doesn't say we are going to select Dominion. The rule doesn't have a cost built in because, quite frankly, we're in the middle of negotiating those costs. So I guess I'm confused as to how Douglas County believed by asking for something that is codified in statute, what, you know, the regulatory analysis, the information we're supposed to give back in a regulatory analysis, how we would have answered those questions when we are analyzing a rule that does not specify any of that.
Well, certainly we understand there would be some things that could not be definitively answered in that. But I think in our response, which you already have and I won't belabor, we've raised a lot of the concerns and costs that are obvious despite not being able to put exact figures or numbers on those. And if the Secretary of State's office already knows the system they're intending to go with, it's not a stretch to then examine what would going with that single system be? What cost would that be on the counties? I realize the Secretary may change his mind, and they may go with several vendors, they may go with a different vendor. But we can still explore the costs and what those may be, and that's really what we were looking for. And I think our response lays those out as we see them. And that's why we feel it's not disingenuous to feel like those costs feel like they're being ignored, even if they are not.
And you're aware that the recommendation came out of a committee that had been meeting for about 3 years, two and a half years. Those were all public meetings.
Yes.
Certainly costs were explored at those meetings. Have you gone back and
looked
at that record?
Yes. I have not. I mean, I couldn't give you an analysis of the findings of that board. I do find it interesting, and we noted for you that that board did vote 5-2 that there should be more than one system. So choosing a single system would seem to ignore that recommendation, but...
And I guess that gets to my next point, because I'm a little confused about what Douglas County is advocating.
Okay.
Are you advocating for two systems, or are you advocating for that the secretary has no authority to mandate even two?
We have concerns, and I think those come out in our response, that we're not sure the secretary has the authority to take a system that meets all the qualifications laid out in statute and to refuse to certify or approve or either a fully qualifying system. Our reading of the statute is that that choice by statute belongs with the governing body of the political subdivision, not with the Secretary of State's office. Although the legislature has laid out specific criteria for when the Secretary of State may not certify, creating a unified system is not one of those criteria.
Okay. And you understand that none of the systems that were piloted are certified?
I understand that none of them are permanently certified. They were all temporarily certified. I understand that.
Right. Yes. But there hasn't been certification. And it has always been a responsibility of the county to buy election equipment. Isn't that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. And in the past, every year that there's a state question, the state reimburses counties a certain amount for conducting elections. You're aware of that, aren't you?
Of course.
Okay. So I guess when you talk about this being some sort of unfunded mandate, how is it different than what already has existed for?
Well, let me put it to you this way. If our county, we'll say Douglas County, chooses to use the legacy system, they will be paid a certain amount for running a state election. If they choose to go to a new system under this new rule, they must choose Dominion, and that will cost them a significant amount of money beyond what they want to spend for a system they do not want. Is the state going to reimburse them for that, or are they going to pay them the same amount of money as though they had not changed systems? This is a decision by the secretary that will impose financial burden, but will not add any reimbursement for that. The reimbursement that we get is for conducting the election. We get that same amount whether we change systems or not.
And the reimbursement, I mean, that's not specified in the rule. I mean, there could be reimbursement. Would that would take care of your concerns?
I think if the state was paying for the system, that may change some minds. But I have not heard anyone say the state is going to pay for these systems. If that could change things, yes.
Okay.
I still think legally there's some question about whether a fully qualifying system, whether there's discretion to not approve and certify that system.
What would your position be if there were conditions of use beyond a certification make systems compatible with Colorado's election model?
Such as?
Such as ability to adjudicate a ballot.
What would I think if there was, I guess I don't understand your question.
Don't all systems
have to adjudicate a ballot?
Well, not electronically. I mean, not all systems have to have something scanned in and then be able to adjudicate on a screen. Some systems require that the ballot be duplicated and then run through again. So do you think the secretary has authority to mandate certain conditions of use beyond just strict certification for the purpose of having election systems that function well under our current model?
I think the secretary has the authority granted under the statute to ensure that the legislatively mandated requirements are met.
Right.
If the secretary's position is that there are certain requirements that go beyond what the legislature has imposed, I am not sure he has the authority for that.
Okay, but conditions of use are something that the secretary has authority over in rule, and rules have the force and effect of law. I guess I'm just getting at how far you think this argument goes. Is it your position that if you are certified at the federal level, that that's the end of the discussion?
Certainly not.
Okay.
The statute clearly says that certification at the federal level is one of the requirements. But there are additional requirements that the legislature has asked all systems to meet.
Okay. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. I'm happy to answer questions. So our concern is that these costs are not being considered as part of this decision. There are considerable costs. And we've already discussed kind of the legal aspect, and that was the other thing I was asked to ensure that we get on the record, is that there's concern here that this may be a bit of an overreach, that if a system, we had four systems that were temporarily certified, I would presume that means that they met all of the requirements for certification, with some exception, perhaps they weren't as thoroughly vetted, but that if all four of those systems do meet the qualifications required, we're not sure there's authority within the statute for the secretary to refuse. The statute says shall certify and approve qualifying systems. And the statute says that the governing body of political subdivisions will choose from those systems. The policy and the proposed rule change would appear to change that to secretary of state will choose.
Well, I mean, certification and approval to purchase are two different things, aren't they? There's a statute that says we have approval over purchases, correct?
There is, but in the statute, and I don't have them in front of me, but they are covered in our written response. It says the Secretary of State shall certify and approve qualifying systems under Part 6.
So if something is approved, then you think that's just a ministerial function of the Secretary, that approval to purchase?
Ministerial to the effect that the Secretary of State's office is required to ensure that all those systems meet the qualifications set out by the legislature. Beyond that, yes, I think that may be overreach. For the Secretary to impose his own qualifications above and beyond what the legislature has asked him to do.
What if a county is attempting to buy a piece of equipment that the Secretary's office knows isn't going to work for the county? They're attempting to buy a high-speed scanner in a county that has 600 voters. Do you think we have authority to deny the purchase of a $100,000 piece of equipment?
If the piece of equipment that they want is a qualifying piece of equipment, it is the choice of the county whether they want that system or not. It should not be the choice of the Secretary of State to dictate to the counties what is the best system for them.
Even if we know it's not going to work?
If the county disagrees with you, if there's a disagreement between the county and the Secretary of State, if you're asking me if the Secretary of State and the county disagree, who should be the decider of what system to purchase? If both systems qualify under the law, the decision should be with the ones who have to pay for the system, which would be the county, not the Secretary of State. So if they choose to spend the taxpayer money on a system that the Secretary of State thinks is unnecessary, that is something the voters can take up with their elected officials.
Well, unnecessary is different than won't work. Right.
If it won't work, then it shouldn't be a qualifying system.
Well, it can work in one county and not work in another. I mean, can you?
I concede that is within the realm of possibilities, but it seems remote that if the system is fully qualified under the statute, it wouldn't work in a county.
It's happened. Okay.
So that is the extent of my comments. I'm welcome to answer any other questions any of you may have.
Anybody have any other questions?
Thanks.
All right. Next is David Wunderlich from Jefferson County.
Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to present these comments to supplement the written comments that were submitted by Jefferson County. My name is David Wunderlich. I'm an assistant county attorney with Jefferson County, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Jefferson County Clerk and Recorder and the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners. I'll try to keep my testimony brief, as we already submitted written comments. Jefferson County agrees with the position taken by Douglas County regarding the imposition of additional costs that would be faced by the counties under the current status of the selection of the Dominion system above and beyond the other systems that were piloted. The price quote that we have from December for all four pilot systems demonstrates the difference in costs, even after you adjust for differences in county size as far as number of scanning stations and other equipment that would have to be bought for a county of Jefferson County size. We also have a concern that the price quote from the pilot committee only considers the carrying cost for the initial 10 years of use. We have some uncertainty as to the future of the system in the event that only a single vendor is approved for use in the state of Colorado. As you know, every system has an end of useful life. Regulatory changes can come at any time, both from the Secretary of State's office or from the Colorado legislature, like we've seen with the risk-limiting audit legislation. And so, as Mr. Pratt pointed out, there's no guarantee that a system certified for 2016 would be useful in 2017, 18, 19, or beyond. With one sole vendor in the state of Colorado approved, counties would be left with little recourse in the event that a future qualifying system was phased out or otherwise obsolete, especially in the face of what I would term to be a leveraged price quote for a successor system if there is a monopoly situation. The systems that Jefferson County used in last year's election in 2015 were piloted by the ESNS Corporation Election Software and Sales, and were able to perform the risk-limiting audit that we are preparing to perform for the 2017 election satisfactorily. Given the importance of the risk-limiting audit, it's important for the clerk and recorder to basically have practice performing that task in preparation for the real deal in 2017 when the risk-limiting audit is formalized. Given the timing of the Dominion system provision under the currently proposed policy, we would be faced with using a temporarily certified system again for 2016 and only beginning to use the Dominion system for the 2017 election the first time that the risk-limiting audit is formally required. That gives us some uncertainty about the performance of that system. Certainly, I know that the Secretary would not certify a system that is incapable of performing those tasks, but given the gravity of the risk-limiting audit, we feel that it's important to have some preparation and experience using the systems to perform that task in advance of the elections where it's actually required. We also take...
Maybe this is a question for staff, but it was my understanding that the risk-limiting audit can be conducted by any system. That's not part of the uniform voting system. I mean, you can continue to use whatever system you want. It's not part of the tabulation system. The risk-limiting audit is a post-election function. Is that...
Are you suggesting that we would purchase two parallel systems?
No, I'm suggesting that right now many counties use other vendors to perform risk-limiting audits. I'm just asking, does your comment assume that the risk-limiting audit is part of the uniform voting system?
No, my comment assumes that counties have capital budgets that are limited for purchase of equipment, and if we are purchasing one voting system at the direction of this office, the Secretary of State's office, there wouldn't necessarily be the financial capability or political will to purchase an additional concurrent system in order to perform the risk-limiting audit. Now, I know that any uniform voting system that the Secretary of State's office approves is going to have the capability to perform a risk-limiting audit. Practically speaking, the Jefferson County Clerk and Recorder has been preparing for the 2017 risk-limiting audit utilizing equipment that was in the pilot program for this year, and given the timeframes involved, potentially using that same equipment for 2016, then would be faced with the training learning curve of implementing a new system, training staff, doing the risk-limiting audit, in effect, using the new equipment for 2017 in the first time, the first year that it's required, and that gives us some concern.
So that assumes that the county, that this ESNS system that was piloted will obtain certification, and that the county would have then purchased that system? Because that system's not certified for...
Currently, no, it's not. Right. And yes, that is making the assumption that the county would pursue certification and obtain certification for that equipment moving forward.
Thank you.
We have some concerns as set forth in the letter, and since they are set forth in the letter, I'll be brief about this. There is no provision in the rulemaking for any review of a uniform voting system on a periodic or ongoing basis. as far as performance-based aspects of a uniform voting system are concerned, if it's statutorily or regulatorily mandated, we would ask that the secretary consider some type of periodic review so that we can have performance metrics or other review on a periodic basis to determine whether the system continues to work for Jefferson and for the other counties in the state. With regard to the application of the rules statewide, having a uniform voting system for all 64 counties, I think almost on its face is not going to be the most efficient solution. 64 counties in Colorado are very diverse. Jefferson County is a large county with hundreds of thousands of voters and a corresponding budget. Smaller counties don't have the same flexibility. We're empathetic to the situation of those counties, but at the same time, Jefferson County is concerned about the significant incremental costs that would be imposed to pursue the Dominion system over our preferred vendor, which is the ES&S system, and even over the other two vendors that were piloted as well. And the rest of our comments are contained in the written comments we submitted. If you have any questions at this time, I would be happy to answer them.
So is your position, I guess, similar to Douglas County, that you believe that if a system is certified, that the function of the secretary's office in approving the purchase is essentially ministerial?
Yes, I do agree with Mr. Pratt's comments about the function of the secretary to approve the purchase of previously certified systems. I think that if a county insists on purchasing a system that's not going to work for them, and the secretary says this system is a bad idea, take notice in writing that it's not going to work for you, and the county goes ahead despite those warnings and purchases it, it would be mismanagement on behalf of the county. But as the taxing entity, as the elected officials for those taxpayers, the county should be making those decisions about what equipment to buy.
Okay.
If it's certified.
What about the secretary's authority as the supervisor of state elections? Let me give you a scenario. What if a county wants to mix and match systems? They want to have their in-person voting be one system and their mail ballot tabulation be another system, and then they're going to add those up on a calculator.
Well, I think that it goes back to, Suzanne, what you were saying about conditions of use. For certified systems, if there are deficiencies identified for certified systems, in practice, the secretary is empowered by statute to impose conditions of use, and it would be within the secretary's authority to issue in that situation. For example, let's say an emergency rulemaking saying that the use of this system in conjunction with this X system in conjunction with Y system would create an irresolvable conflict that's going to ruin the election in your county, you know, you can't do that. If it's a matter of mismanagement, I'm not really sure where the secretary's authority to command the use of county tax funds would stop as the supervisor of elections. If a county insists on persisting down a course of action that the secretary has made clear is not advisable, the secretary does have emergency rulemaking authority.
So you think it would be appropriate in a condition of use?
I think that as a condition of use, the secretary does have authority as a state supervisor of elections to ensure that the elections are run in an appropriate fashion. But I agree with Mr. Pratt's statements that the certification criteria for equipment are set forth in statute. And if something is federally certified and meets the additional minimum standards set forth in Part 6 of Title 1, then the secretary should approve or shall approve those systems.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Merlin Klotz from Douglas County.
First, I want to thank Susan and Secretary of State Wayne for spending some time with us discussing one-on-one some of our concerns. And we've submitted, I think, all of our concerns, most of our concerns in writing. You should have them on file. I'd appreciate you study them closely. I'm clerk and recorder, Douglas County. Not quite as legally versed as my two previous speakers, but I'm a CPA by background, so obviously I move toward about three places in my focus. The first is internal control, the second is efficiencies, and the third is people. I'll try and stay brief. I've got three concerns. One goes to the principal, one goes to the operational aspects, and one goes to the legal. And setting aside the apparent cost differentials that Douglas County sees from the so-called final costs that the vendors submitted. In principle, I have difficulty in hanging the next 20 years' future of elections in the state of Colorado on the financial health of a single vendor. I remember Polaroid. I remember Braniff. I remember Atari. And there was a time when they appeared invincible. I have, in my comments, long before there was a decision made, long before the committee made a decision, I was making comments to the committee suggesting the validity of more than one vendor. I have my favorite vendor, yes, but I think that the state and the counties are at risk in hanging their hat on a single vendor. Whether you look at it from the financial health aspect, whether you look at it from the aspect of competition for the most recent, most current available systems that are out there, whether you look at it from what happens after the initial guaranteed period of service costs, I think there's multiple reasons that there's validity in more than one vendor on the table. I think I do recognize the benefits that Secretary of State's office would have in simplifying the back office process in supporting, be it by rule or by doing the builds, all those pieces that you have to do on your side in simplifying that process. And for that reason, I think there's value in using some similar systems. I like the systems that they're using off-the-shelf equipment from that perspective. It simplifies your back office piece. But I don't think that there's value from the from a principal perspective. I don't think there's value in neglecting the impact on the counties in getting efficiencies in your back office.
Well, let me stop you there, because when you talk about our back office, and you and I have had this discussion, you know, your neighboring county, Elbert, has had turnover of their clerk and their election staff twice in the last 5 years.
Yes.
And there was no county that could help them because they had a system that was unique to Elbert.
Yes.
Right? In that case, where there's a state election, it's really incumbent on the secretary's office then to step in and figure out how to run that election, because we have a state question, we have a responsibility that you recognize. Is it your proposal that we continue to have, you know, 10, 18, 20 different systems, you know, circulating around Colorado, that we don't have any ability to mandate some sort of uniformity, not for our back office functions, but for the functions of counties and our ability to, you know, administer statewide elections?
I think you made my point well.
Okay.
I believe we need a minimum of systems, be it two, be it three, be it four, but I think we need a minimum of systems that are similar in design, similar in approach. For example, two of the systems use the same scanners. I think in getting to some similarity in process, similarity in design. Absolutely. That was a situation where had we had a minimum of systems, we would have been able across the board somewhere to provide support naturally instead of having the disaster that you went through trying to support it. You made my point exactly.
Okay.
Thank you. I feel it's an unfunded mandate. That's for the legal guys to decide. But if the state's writing the check, then I think we lose a lot of the ability to say we disagree with the decision. From an operational perspective, systems have differences. And even when I look at my preferred system and the Secretary of State's preferred system, they're similar in many respects. But one of the major differences from an operational perspective is that, as I understand the Secretary of State's preferred system, it's got a single fail point. It's a server-based system. Now, servers don't fail unless they're mined. And as a server-based system, in the way that it was spec'd in the final cost projection, counties the size of Denver would have had two servers. They had a backup. If I was sitting in a rural county using a server-based system, and that server failed at 4 o'clock on election day, I'm SOL. On the other hand, the operational design of my preferred system uses multiple high-powered PCs with hot swappable hard drives. Now, by doing that, if I'm sitting in Sagooch or Moffat County or somewhere and my server failed on election day, all I have to do is swap the box and swap the hard drives over and I'm back in business. Now, it's an operational kind of consideration that this risk I would much rather see at the county level. Do they want to take that risk or not? There are a variety of operational pieces like that that I don't think have been thoroughly considered. By the same token, operationally, the system that the secretary prefers uses a server concept in the polling places. Garfield County, that's 104 miles round trip between home base and their farthest polling place. With a server-based system at the polling place, they have to, they've got more transportation. They have to have a higher level of competence to go out and daisy chain the server and the print devices and all those pieces together. My note from Gilpin County said we'll have to hire a van to make that trip for. If we stick with the secretary's preferred vendor. On the other hand, my preferred vendor, it's self-contained. It's all in one unit. And the data that determines the style of ballots is contained on a thumb drive instead of on a server. And so an election judge with nominal training, nominal ability IT-wise, can go out at the 104 miles or the one-way 50 miles and open it up and plug in the printer and he's running. So there's operational considerations that I think haven't been thoroughly addressed and should be the choice of the county. Do they want to take the risk? I think that's up to them if they want to take the risk for a single fail point. I appreciate the work of the committee, the PERC committee, and I've got a number of friends on the committee, at least I did have. But the thing that bothered me about that approach, it was third person. It wasn't first person. None of the committee actually operated any of the equipment. They observed. But even in observation, I'm not aware that any one committee member observe, for example, ballot creation on all four systems, or ballot resolution on all four systems. They got to what they could. I appreciate the work they put in, but I think that there would have been value in having some more first person and some more true comparative work across the four systems.
I would imagine that our representative Dwight Shulman probably observed all of that.
He probably, I don't think he saw ballot creation, for example, on all four systems. I'm sure that Clarice saw one or two, three. Dwight probably saw two or three. I'm not sure that anybody actually saw the ballot creation in all of the systems. The committee did a good job. I'm not challenging the committee. I'm just saying it's an aspect that weakens the ability to give a real hard conclusion. I think it's important, as was noted earlier, to recognize that, yes, there was three questions put to the committee. The first was, if you picked a single vendor, who would it be? The second was, do you believe there should be more than one vendor? And on that question, it was 5-2 that they would prefer more than one vendors. I believe that even the committee saw value in having more than one vendors. I realize the benefits in minimizing the number of vendors, be it the Elbert County situation, be it your back room. There's strong validity in minimizing, but I think they need to be similar in approach, similar in design, in order to benefit and keep the competition, and be it in service price down the road, but be it in advances in technology. And the last point, my previous speakers addressed, but I do have concerns that a single vendor is subject to some legal challenge. I'm not an attorney, but it does not feel like what I'm seeing that is legally pure to go with a single vendor. Thank you for time.
Thank you. Any questions? Yeah.
So Merlin, I had just to make sure that you were aware of this, the evaluation process that the PERC committee undertook, which ended up to be 2.5-3 years long.
Yeah.
As I understand it, and in my conversations with the Elections Assistance Commission in Washington, D.C., that they have established this as a best practice. And the fact that we evaluated four different systems in various counties, large and small, around the state, in a live election, as we understand it, was the first time that had ever been done. And for that reason, brought about an understanding of those systems at a level that no other state had ever had prior to making a decision like this. So I wanted to make sure that you understood that the evaluation of the system was taken very, very seriously.
Yeah, I appreciate that. What I'm pointing out is there is another level that we had opportunity to take it to. And I think the committee did get it right to the extent of saying that we needed more than one vendor. And I was pointing out the weaknesses in it. I think they did a good job. And I would believe it probably is a best practice compared to everything else that's been done in the past. So
thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Merlin. Next, we have Martha Tierney.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Martha Tierney. I'm here on behalf of the Colorado Democratic Party. And I'm going to comment on three of the proposed rules. And I'll be submitting written comments just for clarification. How long is the record going to remain open?
A week from Friday.
Okay.
So, week from tomorrow.
Great. So the first rule I want to comment on is Rule 7.2.6. I believe that Rule 7.2.6 is void under the Colorado Administrative Procedures Act at 24.4.103, and that it cannot be amended, therefore. So all of that rule should be stricken. In 2015, the General Assembly explicitly disapproved Rule 7.2.6 by choosing not to extend it. While it was a longer rule at that time, the existing rule and the amendment, the existing rule that is being amended here was a big piece of that rule. And under that scenario, the APA requires an agency to revise the rule to conform with that action. Instead, the rule was impermissibly repromulgated in August, and now here's an attempt to amend it. By repromulgating an expired rule, the Secretary has not acted consonant with the APA, but has repromulgated in substantial part a previously disapproved rule.
Let me ask you about that.
Yeah.
I mean, commonly agencies correct the issue, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of your sentence.
Commonly, agencies then correct the deficiency.
They can.
What is, was there any record on the deficiency? I guess that's the issue we're having.
So there was a record in the General Assembly's Rules Committee, and I believe I may have submitted a transcript of that to my comments to the prior rule last August. But I could get it to you again if you would like.
Yeah, if you could put that in your
comments. So there was lots of discussion about that rule, and there were two parts to that rule, but the discussion was on both parts. Both the original rule had a prohibition or a mandate that you vote your ballot in private.
Right, and that's gone.
And then it also had the language that now that says for third party delivery, I'm giving my ballot to, and then the voter is supposed to write a name there, and then that is language that's supposed to go on the outside of the envelope.
Right.
So there was discussion in that committee about both parts of that rule, and the committee voted not to extend, and so then the repromulgation of that rule under the Colorado APA makes that a void rule, and thus any amendment to that void rule, I think, is improper at this point, because the amendment doesn't make any sense without the part of the rule that's void. So the whole rule at this point is void.
Okay.
So because that rule revives a significant portion of its expired predecessor rule, it should be stricken and in its entirety. Okay, the next rule is Proposed Rule 8.13 also is contrary to Colorado statute, exceeds the Secretary of State's rulemaking authority, and should not be adopted. First, Colorado Revised Statute 1.7.5.1073 specifically requires that it is the election judge, not the watcher, who is to compare the signature on the self-affirmation form on each return envelope with the signature of the eligible elector stored in SCORE.
What rule?
8.13.
I have that as... I have 8.1.3. I was looking at the wrong one.
Okay.
You're right. I was looking at 8.1.3.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
While Colorado Revised Statute 1.7.108 allows watchers to witness and verify, this new rule essentially sets forth a new challenge process for challenging mail ballots that violates Colorado Revised Statute 19207, and it directly conflicts with the last sentence of existing rule 8.10.2, and which makes clear that witness and verify means to personally observe actions of election officials in each step of the conduct of an election. Witness and verify does not give watchers the right to audit an election step separate from observing the work of the election judges. Finally, there is no statutory authority anywhere in Title I for escalating up to 10 ballot envelope signatures per hour to a secondary review. Proposed Rule 8.13 should not be adopted.
So, Martha, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So, if the watcher has any role in signature verification, How do they effectuate that role? How do they make their concerns known about something that's happening in the signature verification process? This rule posits one way that they could do that. Do you have any other thoughts on how that can be done outside of this rule?
Well, I think the way that our watcher scheme is set up now, the watcher would raise a concern to this, whoever their contact is, the supervisory election judge or the watcher contact, and make clear that there is an election judge that is not properly trained or is not doing what they're supposed to be doing, and that the supervisory judge needs to look into that and take action. And then if they do not, then the watcher has the recourse to go to their appointing authority, and they'll have to escalate it to this office or the clerk's office or court.
So to me, that sounds like the current procedure, because that's basically what happens in a county where there's a concern about a signature. I think the problem that watchers have expressed to our office is that by the time they're able to find a supervisory judge that will listen to them, and then the judge who's potentially failing at the signature verification process expresses that concern to that judge, by then that signature, that vote which has been counted or potentially pulled aside, is sort of lost in the process, and there's no way to go back and re-adjudicate that signature. How is there a way, under what you believe our authority is, for a watcher to in some way stop the process so that their concerns about a particular signature can be addressed at the time without it being passed through that system and lost to their objection?
No. I think that the General Assembly would have to take that up and make a statutory change. I think it's a fundamental difference between the role of a watcher, which is to watch the conduct of an election, and the role of an election judge, which is to conduct the election. And it's not the role of the watcher to be able to say, I want that signature looked at again. The watcher can go to the election judge supervisor and say, hey, this election judge needs better training, and you should take a look at the last 10 signatures because they were reading a comic book instead of looking at the thing. And if the supervisor election judge wants to do that, fine. But it is not the role of the watcher to get to play that trump card 10 times a freaking hour.
You're representing the Colorado Democratic Party. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party probably have the majority of the watchers in the state of Colorado. Not to put you on the spot, but were a bill like that to come up, would that be something that the party could support? Would that be something that that you could work with a legislator to formulate in a way that you would, that the party would be in favor of?
I am not in favor of that kind of interference by watchers. So, I mean, I'd certainly come to the table in good faith and talk about what might be a way to meet the concerns. But having the watcher be able to interfere in that way, I think, is not the role of the watcher. The definition of watcher is watch. And then the last rule that I wanted to comment on is 8.15.5. And it's really just to piggyback on 8.13, and that's, this rule is apparently giving the authority to the watcher to interact with election judges in the signature verification context. And because we think that rule 8.13 is improper, we think that that portion of 8.15.5 is improper.
But isn't 8.15.5 just saying they can't interact with an election judge other than the...
It's the other than part, Madam Deputy Secretary.
Other than the designated watcher contact?
No, it's the part that's referring to...
Oh, 1 point. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. So if that was stricken, you'd be fine with it?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, I think otherwise that's a great rule.
Okay.
So
what I was thinking.
I have nothing further, unless there are any questions.
Any question?
All right. And I'll submit some written comments within the timeline. Thanks.
All right, next we have Elena Nunez.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. My name is Elena Nunez. I'm the executive director of Colorado Common Cause. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that works for open and accountable government and to increase participation in the political process. First, I just want to say we appreciate the revisions to Rule 11.3.2. We had commented in the previous draft that we had concerns about removing the requirement that machines for logic and accuracy testing be randomly selected, and appreciated seeing that corrected in this draft. So thank you. On a couple of other rules, first, Rule 6.2.1, we oppose the adoption of this rule. We don't think it's an appropriate rule for the political parties to make the designation of which judges should serve as signature verification judges. We recognize that political parties have a role in the appointment of judges and in fact, need to submit names and submit judges, but to actually put that placement authority with the political parties rather than the election judges, we think is bad policy and also contrary to the statute, which gives election judges, or gives the role of selecting election judges for functions to county clerks. And so we think that that's the appropriate way to do it. You've already seen from some of the comments submitted by others that there are unaffiliated and minor party judges who want to continue to be able to serve. And again, we think that election judges should be selected on the basis of their ability to perform a function and not on the preference purely of a political party. Likewise, Rules 6.4.1 and 6.4.2, we again oppose the adoption of these rules as well, which would allow the political party chairs to determine if staff would be serving as election judges to conduct signature verification. It gives the authority for a waiver to the political party chairs rather than the Secretary of State or the county clerks or whatever. We think if there is a need to limit staff serving as signature verification judges, that needs to be explicit in one instances that is appropriate and not appropriate. There may be statutory changes needed to reflect that, but at any rate, giving the waiver authority to the political parties is inappropriate. We also oppose the adoption of the amendments to Rule 7.2.6. I think Ms. Tierney's comments went through them in detail. We also would direct this office, of course, to the memo that was prepared for the Committee on Legal Services, as well as your office's own response that Rule 7.2.6 is void, so making additions to that at this time is inappropriate. And of course, we also oppose the adoption of the rule on the substance and have submitted comments on that previously, so we continue to urge this office not to go in that direction and require third-party information about someone who's dropping off a ballot. We don't think that that's authorized in statute. Rule 8.9, we support this rule. This was a conversation that came up in the Watcher advisory group over the summer, and we think that this is a good policy to make sure that voters who are voting in a residential facility can cast their ballot in private, and we think that's an important clarification and rule to protect the privacy of those voters. And then finally, Rule 8.1.3, we oppose the adoption of this rule. Again, I know this was a subject of much conversation over the summer at the Watcher Advisory Group, and trying to figure out a way to give watchers a role in the signature verification process was important for many, but I think that this oversteps the authority of the office to create a different process for challenges to be made. And I think the group had trouble coming up with a way that watchers could, in fact, escalate a signature or escalate that there is a problem. But at any rate, we have a process for mail ballot challenges, and this doesn't conform with that. So to give a watcher the ability to escalate a signature absent that authority in statute, we think is problematic. So we would oppose the adoption of this rule as well. And with that, those are the comments I had, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I have a question on the language on the back of the envelope. Mm-hmm. Do you have any alternatives in mind for how to enforce that 10 ballot rule? I mean, prior to 1303, there was a log that was kept at the clerk's office. That was the statutory mechanism. And would you be opposed to the secretary reimposing a log? Or, you know, do you have other thoughts on how that could be enforced?
I don't think it is enforceable, in part because we have 24-hour drop boxes, and my understanding is even when there was a log, that the use of the log wasn't always consistent. So I'm not sure that there is an easy way to do it, and I think, practically speaking, when there's many opportunities for voters to return ballots, whether it's at a VSPC, at a drop box, a 24-hour drop box, I don't know that it's practical to try to keep track of that. I think that's an issue that requires further conversation about the goals of that statute and whether or not it still works, given the model and how voters are voting.
Right, but when it's on the books, we have to, I mean, we don't get to decide that we're going to ignore it. I mean, it's there. How do you feel about the language that says it's still counted? I mean, that question's come up numerous times too. What if you do have somebody that comes in with extra, what are you supposed to do with those ballots?
Right. Well, I mean, absolutely it needs to be counted because you shouldn't disenfranchise a voter based on who they chose to give their ballot to.
Right. So you don't have an objection to that part of the rule?
Well, I don't have an objection to voters having their votes counted, but we still oppose that there would be a rule that would put that information on. And I think, practically speaking, having an additional set of language, another affidavit, creates confusion for voters. And my concern is, one, that voters may or may not fill that portion out. But two, I worry if they fill that out instead of the other one, or they get confused, or that having that affidavit on there at all is chilling and they feel like they can't give it to the person of their choice, that it creates other issues other than whether or not it can be counted, although, of course, it should be counted. So.
Okay.
So I had a quick clarification. So in your discussion of 6.4.1, you're not opposed to the idea of limiting staff to do signature verification. You're more opposed to the fact that it's the party that signs off and not the Secretary of State's office. So if the rule said that if the county wishes to have staff do signature verification and they seek a waiver from the Secretary of State's office, Common Cause would be okay with that wording.
I'm not opposed to having a conversation about why that would be necessary. I am not sure if it's appropriate in rule versus statute, and we'd have to see. I don't remember from the conversations we had over the summer as part of the Watcher Advisory Group. I know there were conversations about staff serving as signature verification judges. I don't remember hearing here are instances when that's being abused or not, but I think regardless the policy, whether it ends up being a statutory change or it can be done in rule, and I'm not sure that it can, it would need to be clear, and those standards would need to be the same. So, for example, if there are no judges available or there's some reason that there, you know, it would have to be spelled out. And this just seems like an arbitrary, if a county wants to do it and the parties think that's great, it can, and I just don't think that's appropriate. But as for putting a restriction on staff serving as signature verification judges, I think that's a broader conversation, and I don't know that it can be accomplished by a rule.
Okay, I think one of the concerns that made this part of the rulemaking is that counties are differently positioned. So you have very large counties which have extensive staffs and a large bullpen of judges that can perhaps have a lot of experience doing this. And then you have other counties where like the only employee in the county that works in the county clerk's office is the county clerk. And the county clerk at various times may have their name on that ballot somewhere running for a particular office, and they certainly have their name in the upper right-hand corner on the top of the ballot. Mm-hmm. So the idea that that clerk or someone working very closely with that clerk would be the person signing off on the acceptability of a ballot, I think, was where those conversations came from. Do you guys have a position just generally on that concern?
I would share that concern, and I think it's an appropriate topic for further discussion. And then I think the correct answer would be to have a set of standards that can be applied across counties. And there may be distinctions between counties based on size, which the rule attempts to do, but it can't be just on the basis of size and then defer to what the political parties agree on. I think it has to be a set of criteria that can be applied across counties. And so that's the conversation I'd be interested in having. I just don't think we're there yet with this rule.
Thanks.
Anyone else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Matt Crane from Arapahoe County.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to provide input this morning. My name is Matt Crane. I'm the Arapahoe County Clerk and Recorder. I'm here this morning to talk about Rule 8.13. Arapahoe County had the unique experience in the 2015 election of being, I think, the only county that had the opportunity to go through with this new procedure. And so I just wanted to talk about our process a little bit. We created a pad of 10 watcher cards, which I'll leave you guys. check out. We actually had one watcher come in who did want to have the ability to challenge signatures. So we were able to check out the pad to the watcher. We had to have, we haven't been able to find a better description for it. So we have what we call watcher minders when they come in. And we assigned a watcher minder to the watcher that came in and stood with him as he went through the process. The watcher did challenge one signature. It was in tier two, the second phase or the third phase as it would be for our process. And they go through. So when he comes in, when the watcher came in, we noted his name, you know, the time he came in, the date, so on and so forth. He got the pad. He went through and filled it out properly. And what we did at that point in time was tier twos, where we have our bipartisan team. We gave it to a second bipartisan team. The ballot continued on through the process. So it was fairly seamless, but it was one watcher in a very small election. So at this time, I would have to say that I'm opposed to this rule going into effect at this point. You know, the election industry has taken leaps and bounds over the last 10 or 15 years because we've become much more reliant on data. What does the data show us? How should we move forward? And quite frankly, we don't have enough data on this rule to understand what the true impact would be when we only had it happen in one county on one day with one watcher. You know, if you think about what we're looking at, if we go back to 2014, we had a close house district race in Arapahoe County. We had almost 20 watchers in our signature verification at one point. If we have to check out 20 pads to these watchers and have 20 additional people to be watcher minders for each of these people, because we don't want to take our normal signature verification people and assign them to them, because we don't want to slow down the process that way. It drives cost, and it would become a confusing situation in our signature verification process. So I think, and we hear this from other counties as well, there's a lot of concern about this. Aside from the legality of it, when we're talking about the practical application of this rule, there's a lot of concern about how it would work, how it would affect counties, and I just don't think we have enough data yet to move forward with it.
Let me ask you, what if there was more discretion to the county clerk in the rule? What if it wasn't 10? If it was, you pass it out, and at the point that you believe it's disruptive, you can
go away. I think more discretion would obviously be better. I think, you know, for me, speaking just for Arapahoe County, the 10 is problematic. If I were to create something like this, if it were to be legally justified to do so, I would much rather see something to the effect of, if a watcher comes in and in an hour challenge three signatures that turn out to be the decision of the judges turns out to be held up, then I'd like the ability to dismiss the watcher. Because you can make the determination at that time. You will know if somebody's there to really uphold their duty under the statute and rule of verifying that signature verification is taking place, and they just see one thing that, you know, they want to challenge and stop the process. To your question earlier, I'm sympathetic to that. But I think that, you know, we're all aware there are some watchers out there that probably have something else in mind. And so I think if we had greater latitude to be able to dismiss those watchers, I think that would be great.
Do you think that absent the rule, the counties would have authority to do it as a best practice?
To do this as a best practice?
And to allow a watcher to contact a supervisor judge and say, hey, I...
Oh, I do. Yeah, I think, you know, when you read the statute, I think it could go both ways. So right now, you know, it's somewhat gray. When you look at the statute and the ability to do that, I think you've heard some other arguments this morning that would say, Martha comes down that if the statute isn't there. To me, it's a little more gray, and I would hate to say that an eligible elector of the jurisdiction didn't have an opportunity to raise a flag if they had a concern. So that's the part that I'm sympathetic to. Okay. But I think this rule, I think we need to put a little more thought into it and maybe take a different approach with it.
Okay, thanks.
So along those lines, it sounds like you're advocating the collection of more data to try to better understand it.
Yes.
Does this mean that Arapahoe County is volunteering to be a demo county for
election? No, I'm glad you asked that question. We would be happy to pilot new ideas in the general election, understanding that you know, could make some interesting situations for us. But I wouldn't be here this morning raising concern over the rule if I wasn't willing to come in and say, hey, I'll work with you to see what we can do to see what really works. And I think other counties would too. You know, we just, there's a lot of unrest about the way this rule is written now.
Okay. Thanks. We may follow up with you.
Okay.
Just one more
question.
I hope so,
Jen.
And thanks for your county's willingness to pilot this and the signature verification stuff during the last one, during the last election. In your experience during 2015, you mentioned that when your one watcher came in, you were, he was basically looking at the tier two review, which
right.
for the record basically means that that's at the point where it's already had a set of eyes on it and they've then escalated it so that a bipartisan team of election judges are looking at it.
Right.
And so I think that the way that we have the rule currently written, we contemplated that it would only be at that tier one where it was only that initial review. And I'm just curious whether you think if it was limited to that, whether that would, you know, alter your opinion on the rule at all, or whether you think that that would just create a situation where watchers wouldn't be all that interested in it.
Sure. Two things. And really, tier two in Arapahoe County is the third review of the signatures because we do ASR. You know, the automatic signature verification. So that's actually the third look. If it was just limited in scope to Tier 2, I would feel the same way.
Okay.
We just haven't been able to study it enough. In 2014, like I said, when we got to the highest levels of watchers we had, everybody was focused on Tier 2. Nobody was concerned about Tier 1. And so, as I said before, I just think we need to study it a little bit more. If this is the road we're going to go down, we need to study it a little bit more and come up with something that I think is a little more workable. So
I have a follow-up on that. So the way that your county worked, you were in Tier 2 when this challenge occurred, and or Tier 3, the way that...
We call it Tier 2, but it is really, in effect, our Tier 3. Most of the time, until we get to a certain point post-election, most of the time we have Tier 1 and Tier 2 running at the same time. This watcher, when he came in last year, as most did the year before, you know, with Tier 1, they okay, that's nice, but they want to get to Tier 2, where it's to the actual point that letters are going to be sent because of rejected signature.
So at the Tier 2, when your watcher was making that interruption claim, they were filling out the card to do the interruption, were you then letting that watcher watch the next level of review where you had the second team of bipartisan judges?
Yes.
And what was their reaction to that process? Were they comfortable with the fact that a second group had looked at it, come to a different or similar conclusion, and they were accepting of that conclusion?
Yes.
Or did they continue to be concerned?
No, I think they were accepting of the, you know, conclusion. I think they were accepting of the conclusion. You know, this was, you know, this watcher we had in 2014 too. We challenged a ballot then, and both times the reason was just to see what would happen. And so I think we get a little bit concerned about people that just want to stick their toe in the water as opposed to really having a good reason to challenge a signature.
Okay.
But no, that was he was fine with the process the way it went through.
And I want to reiterate what Ben said. We really appreciate your willingness to take on what are very hard and somewhat complicated issues and test them in your county.
We're always happy to help out. But again, to my point, it wasn't hard this year because you know, there was nothing to do with it. So again, I would stress, you know, let's take a little more time with it.
Well, your willingness to volunteer for 16 is
we're always happy to help.
Quite persuasive.
We're always happy to help.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Amber McReynolds.
Good afternoon. My name's Amber McReynolds, and I am the Director of Elections for the City and County of Denver. And I also serve as the co-chair of the Election Statute Review Committee, and Christy Coburn from Adams County is also here to provide testimony. We're going to kind of each take a few of the rules. First and foremost, thank you for consideration of our comments made on the initial draft. We obviously noted some changes made based on the county feedback. The Election Statute Review Committee is a combination of all counties across Colorado, so we very specifically collect comments and feedback from all the various counties. I will note that what we try to do is we'll only submit comments if there is sort of collective thoughts on a particular thing. If there is variances across counties, we sort of leave that up to the specific county to comment on. But we're going to be submitting written comments, obviously, as soon as we can give counties an opportunity to submit everything to us. But there's a couple of themes that came up on our in our meeting yesterday. We actually had a committee meeting yesterday that we wanted to highlight for verbal comment. First and foremost, with regards to Rule 6.2.1, we do want to echo some of the comments that have been made today. There still remains concern amongst counties in terms of the statutory obligation that county clerks have to assign duties to election judges, and so we continue to be concerned about sort of shifting that authority to the political parties, given the county's role in that, and often counties use training or use hands-on experience to sort of assess the skill levels and what have you of the judges. Also, 6.2.1, as well as sort of in relation to 6.4.1, we still have we appreciate the modifications made from the original draft. However, we're still very concerned about the written consent of the political parties on how full-time staff should be allocated to duties assigned within the election process. This was very consistent across counties in terms of concern around this. There appears to be sort of a different process set up here for smaller counties versus the rest of the counties, so there was concern about disparity there. We're very concerned about the process of obtaining consent, the back and forth that could sort of ensue with the political parties, and frankly, the role of the county clerk, not only to assign duties for election judges, but also for our full-time staff allocation. We have the clear authority to assign those duties as appropriate, and so sort of shifting that elsewhere is problematic. Also, there are various instances, including illness, other issues where volume may ensue, where counties may use motor vehicle staff or recording staff or other full-time staff that are allocated to other duties and responsibilities to sort of fill gaps as needed. The counties want to maintain that authority to shift staff appropriately as volume ensues, and this does not sort of support that structure. Finally, frankly, full-time employees have more experience to do detailed research where issues, whether it be score, they have advanced score access, whereas election judges usually have limited score access in terms of document review. They also can do CDOR research, so access to the Department of Revenue's database, and then use other methods to research records if need be. So we again reiterate our concern over sort of the limitations on full-time staff, appreciate the modifications in the rule, but still feel that it doesn't quite get where we need it to get. Finally, 7.2.6, counties continue to have concern over this particular rule. We expressed concern when it was brought forth last year, and also expressed concern in the original draft in December. Support and appreciate the comments made previously, so I won't sort of go over those again. But from an operational compliance administrative impact perspective, we are concerned about voter confusion on this. We already have a lot of metrics, data that sort of shows how we've tried to improve the envelope design to make sure voters sign in the actual space provided to the voter. We've made great strides in that, so adding a third line on the envelope for someone to put their name is problematic. The envelope is already jam-packed full of information that's required to provide to the voter, and that's for counties. Counties have expressed that even just with one language. So when you go to the counties, like Denver is the largest, that is required under Section 203 to provide dual language on the envelope, we have a significant space issue. And we already have issues sort of getting voters to sign in the appropriate place and also accommodate the witness. There's another requirement for additional information for the witness that we very much support, the printed name with the signature. So adding more onto the envelope that really, I think, doesn't solve any particular issues that have come up is problematic, and we want to continue to voice concern about that. And with that, I can take questions, or Christy has comments, and maybe we'll just take questions at the end. Is that?
Oh. So I have one real quick one. Uh-huh. So the assignment of duties. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the party should have any role in determining who should do signature verification?
So one of the things, and this is what Denver has been doing, we actually did employ most or all of the best practices set forth last year with regards to watchers as well as signature verification, and we've actually done most of those things for years. One of the things that we've done for a long period of time is provide a list to the parties of the breakdown of how we've assigned judges, whether it be VSPCs, supervisors, assistant supervisors, signature verification, prep, counting, adjudication. So across the board, a list of judges that have been assigned after training, after they've gone through assessments, after they've passed CBIs, based on their previous experience as well. And so we've given them a list to review in advance of the election. If they have any concerns, they're more than welcome to express those to us. We haven't ever received feedback that they want someone different in the room. Frankly, a lot of our judges are experienced from both parties that are in that room, and I think you know, the parties probably prefer having experienced judges doing that work. I think that's a good approach, to give the parties a chance to look at the list, and if they have concern, let them provide feedback to the county. I don't think that they should have final sign-off, and there's sure to be a written consent process, because I think statute clearly says that clerks have the authority to assign duties.
So this is hard, and I get it. The first level signature review, the statute's pretty unclear as to who can do that. It doesn't really specify. Second level, it clearly says it has to be a Democrat and a Republican, mm-hmm. and that they have to work together.
Right.
So under those circumstances, shouldn't the party have some say as to who that person is? And let's say that you've given them the list. Let's say you've given the Republican Party the list. And they look at the list and they go, we don't want this person representing us in signature verification. What would you do in that circumstance?
I think we would readjust and look at it, but the parties do have impact or input into this because they're the ones that give us the list initially. Mm-hmm. So when we're pulling from them, and then we also obviously take applications throughout the year, even though technically statute says it's the caucus list and you go from there unless you have vacancies. I mean, we've always worked with our parties too, and I mean, all the counties do this, to continue to take sort of referrals, if you will, for election judge duties. But frankly, when you go through the list, and this happens across counties, especially in a partisan year like the 2016 is, what often happens is we get a list from the caucuses, so that's in March. By the time we get close into September, most of those people are either starting to work on a campaign and they're like, no, I'd rather do this, not available for the 2.5 week period. And so we really do rely on those sort of experienced people that come back every time that did obviously were from the party lists. They often fill out the caucus application each time. But I think to sort of put us in this back and forth on consent for full-time, and I think we're talking about full-time staff when it comes to the consent, I think input from the parties is extremely important. I think the counties agree with that. But having them sort of, we already struggle with the timelines, we already struggle with finding people that can work for the allotted amount of time and go through the appropriate training. I mean, when you factor in the amount of time working, the training elements, it's about a month. And a lot of the party people that we get can't commit to that. So they decline the assignment unless it's sort of a 1 day or 2 day or sort of 3 day thing. And so, you know, we have to adjust accordingly with that. And I think just we're concerned about how this process would potentially work. And we definitely have pretty significant concerns with how the parties could get involved with how we allocate full-time staff. I think that's pretty concerning. I don't think you guys would want the parties dictating to you all how you allocate your full-time staff. So it's a critical thing. There was definitely consistency amongst counties in that concern.
So based on how you just described, the way you assign judges and then allow the parties to review that mm-hmm. list of assignment, that is largely in keeping with what we're trying to do with 6.2.1. I guess I see you as that largely being supportive of what we're trying to do, because you are giving the parties a voice in trying to help you figure out who the right people would be for that particular assignment, which is a really critical assignment. And so maybe if you have some wordsmithing that you'd like to submit that might help us to say it in the way that you or the ESRC would find more attractive, we'd be really interested in hearing that.
Yeah, I think so. Kind of like 6.1.4, that's basically the requirement to provide a list of election judges. 45 days is not going to work, and we're going to submit that in comment because we haven't even started training at 45 days. So, you know, that likely will not work because we can't really assign people before we've seen them and had them go through training and filled out paperwork. So, I think in there where we're providing a list to the parties, maybe leave it at that and then leave the part, you know, if the parties have feedback, they give it to us by a certain period of time, and then we, you know, can go from there. That's different than what 6.2.1 says, because this is basically saying the party designates who, and I don't see how they can designate if the person hasn't even committed to the assignment, been through training. We need to know if they can act, you know, have computer skills to do the work, because signature verification is largely that. So 6.1.4 as it is probably better, and then maybe adding some language around having the parties submit comments, and then just sort of get rid of 6.2.1 would probably be the best way to handle it.
So that's helpful. I appreciate that. Yeah. If you did have a reformulation of either 6.1.4 or a way to save 6.2.1, please let us know. We'd love to see that wording.
Yeah, we can. We will, in our comments, I think, provide some feedback on that.
Thank you.
Okay, and then Christy has some more.
Good morning. I'm Christy Coburn with Adams County Clerk and Recorder. I'm the Election Administrator and Chief Deputy, and as Amber mentioned, co-chair with the ESRC with her. I have just a few rules I want to comment upon. Before I do, I'd like to provide supplemental information about the conversation that Judd and Amber were just having regarding the parties appointing signature verification judges. Adams County did pilot this process as a best practice in 2015, and one of our political parties did provide us with a list of judges to use as signature verification judges. So I just want to share our experience very briefly. As Amber mentioned, many of the judges on the list, when we called them and contacted them, could not commit to the time frame. So we were really trying to use these judges, but they were unable to, even though they had been designated by the party, because of the length of time it requires to be trained and, you know, the 2.5 or so weeks that you go through actual signature verification, that we ended up having to backfill with some of the staff we had used before because there just weren't enough people on the list. And in addition, you know, was a drain on our staff to try to be continually in contact with these people. Can they serve even though the party was appointed? So that was difficult. Also, we did experience two of the judges that were willing to serve and that came in. After they went through training, it was apparent they did not have the skill set needed to do signature verification. They shouldn't have the computer skills. One of them just wanted to hit the okay, yes, accept button. So we had one judge we simply had to relocate to another area because they just weren't suitable. The other one we were able to retrain. But again, that was a little, you know, one more step in the process. So I just wanted to share that. I want to specifically comment on Rule 7.8.3 regarding the proposal that election judges resolve signatures in accordance with the Secretary of State's signature verification guide. I think the counties are largely supportive of having a consistent signature verification guide, but it's difficult for us to provide support for the rule without seeing what that guide might look like. So, you know, if you guys could provide a draft or a sample, something, you know, conceptual, that would be really helpful for us. But we're not opposed to it, just hard to support it without seeing it. Regarding Rule 8.1.5, this is requiring that a watcher would complete training provided by the Secretary of State. Counties across the board wholeheartedly support this rule, and we thank you very much and ask that you adopt that. Rule 8.9 is in regards to watchers at healthcare facilities. First, I'd like to say thank you for including the suggested modification that we submitted earlier. We really appreciate that. Our remaining concern is not so much with the rule as it stands, but there have been counties, and Adams is one of them, that healthcare facilities have indicated they will not allow a watcher to attend. Now, we avoided this situation in 2015 because we didn't have any watchers that notified us in advance and asked to be there when we delivered the ballots. But this is a very real concern, and I would ask the secretary to consider and provide directions to counties what they should do if a facility refuses to allow watcher access. They have concerns with HIPAA and private residences. I'm not going to go into all of that right now, but we do ask that you please take a look at that before we get in the situation in October.
Do you have any suggestions for that? I mean, I think we're conflicted like you that the statute says watchers can watch these activities. I mean, our hope, I think, with this rule was that, you know, you would try to accommodate a watcher at a facility that didn't object, and that's why they would contact you first. I mean, I guess that might not always work.
And not speaking for ESRC, but speaking for, right, for me in Adams, yeah, County personally, I absolutely see both sides of this, and I'm not sure what the solution is. There are some concerns with private residences and, you know, whether or not a watcher should be there. On the other hand, watchers should be able to allow to see the public's business, and the public's business is being conducted in healthcare facilities. So I don't know what the solution is. I don't know what the balance is, but I do fear that we have two very strong competing interests, and it may end up in litigation is my best guess. But again, those are comments from Christy and not the ESRC.
One of the other things that came up on the call yesterday with in relation to this is what to do if the HCF obviously doesn't allow watchers in, but then also the private room. So in some instances, the resident cannot leave their room for whatever reason, so the election judges will go in and assist. And so we were kind of thinking that maybe there should be something added about watchers should only be allowed in the common areas within a, you know, because I don't think we, any of us, can kind of dictate whether or not they can enter the private room. So, and maybe it's standing at the door, but I think counties wanted maybe some clarity around that to avoid any, you know, controversy or what have you. So we did want to maybe add something about kind of the common areas as opposed to the private rooms. So,
thank you, Amber. Okay, moving on to Rule 8.13. Several people have spoken about this. We largely agree with the comments that Ms. Tierney submitted. Also, Matt talked about piloting this in 2015. Adams County prepared to pilot it. We were asked to, and we prepared a similar card and log sheet, but nobody came to our party. So I can't give you firsthand experience on that, but I can say that many of the counties that participate in ESRC are very concerned that in a presidential election year where we could have tons of watchers, that this could be very disruptive to the process. So I think we would ask, as Matt mentioned, you know, let's get a little more data on how this would work and try to refine it. And I will also volunteer Adams County again if you would like us to do that in 2016, and then maybe consider this at another time. And then finally, as more of kind of a technical cleanup, on Rule 8.16, this talks about if a watcher disputes a decision by a judge, they have to alert the watcher contact. We would just like to say that if Rule 8.13 is adopted with a minimum, stating that minimum of 10 ballots, that please provide some clarification that 8.16 doesn't trump that. I wouldn't want a watcher to say 8.16 says I get to escalate every proposed objection I have. So just maybe an exception there. And that is all I have. Are there any comments for Amber or I? Or questions, I should say.
Any questions?
No. And then lastly, thank you guys so much. I know how hard it is to do this many pages of rules. We will provide a written comment that touches more on these. And again, thank you so much for your considerations and modifications you made from the pre-notice draft to the notice draft.
And thank you for piloting our ideas and providing us comment to
time.
Our rules. That's everybody I have on the sign-up sheets. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak on these rules?
Good morning. I'm Faye Griffin. I'm county clerk in Jefferson County. And I appreciate the fact that, you know, we're trying to go through these rules and make them work and see whatever. And I should have brought my list. But my main comment is the fact that, you know, if we are going to have one system in the state, my biggest concern is the timing for us to do something this year. We had a successful pilot county that was not chosen, which also was a successful county that did the audit, and so we were really pleased with that. But our real problem is the timing. You know, when we say over and over about testing 10 cards or whatever in a general election, this is our biggest election we have. And My thought is that, you know, if we do need to go to one system throughout the state, or even two, we need to have time to get used to that system, have our employees, our plans all fulfilled, because we don't, any of us, want to have a bad election. And so my biggest comment is the fact that the date timeline is that if there was some way that we could include the counties that use the pilot system successfully, use those in a presidential general election, and then go to the system maybe on the off election year in 2017. That's my biggest concern right now, because we have other equipment in our county, and we're going to update some things, you know, even the, you know, looking at some, but we're saying we have to have this workable and ready before our primary election. So our deadline really is April. And April's just going to be here right around the corner. And if we needed to go to a new system to have the new information in Jefferson County, my time is limited. So that portion, if you could change the dates, rather than that this needs to be done by this year and have it for at least 2017, I would feel a whole lot better. So anyway, thank you. I appreciate your time, and thank you for allowing additional people that did not sign up. And I just want to thank.
Okay. And can I just ask you a question about that? So your preference would be that, I guess I'm trying to figure out, that is, because there's no mandate you go to the system, but what you're saying is you need to go to some kind of other system.
Our system that we have had, ES&S system, prior to this pilot program, we have had a number of years,
right,
back to before I was clerk and recorder.
And you don't want to use that in
it is not certified. We had to get some special equipment attached to the items, and Pam's here, or she was here. She can explain what we had to do to get our system right for 2014.
Okay.
We knew that we had to replace the system. We knew that. And so we were hopeful that whatever we piloted for this last year would be what we'd use for our general election. And my understanding is that I need to have special approval to use that same piloted equipment for this next year. And during this next year, be looking at what kinds of pieces of equipment we would need if we have to go to one system for an off election year. As you know, we had a successful coordinated election, including the recall question on our ballot. And, you know, we were concerned because if we had to do two different kinds of things during this last pilot, but it was a successful election. And again, with the help and all the conversations that we had with your people, and I do want to thank you for that, because it was almost like we're on speed dial. But And we are getting a letter prepared to the secretary asking that very thing. But if the rule, whatever it is, that says the dates on there, that if there's some way that we could use our piloted equipment for this next year, that's really all I can say.
Okay.
Thank you.
So if it was some kind of lease or something, that's what you're
right.
talking about.
Okay. And, you know, whether it's Dominion or what, or if you had another kind of piece of equipment to give or that we would purchase to the counties to have a new system in the large counties in a general election year is scary. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify regarding the rules? All right. Then at this time, our office will take under advisement possible amendments to the Secretary of State's election rules. The record will remain open through close of business Friday, January 22nd, to allow the submission of additional written comments. That concludes today's hearing. The time is 10:50. Thank you.